The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I just have a few thoughts to share with you. And mostly I'm interested in hearing about what your questions are, what your interests are, but then in thinking, I was thinking about coming in and simply doing question and answer, but I thought sometimes it can be helpful to put some thoughts in the room to start. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just talk for a few minutes about a theme, and then we can go from there. And the questions don't have to be directly related to this theme that I'm going to put into the room. You know, one thing that I love about the Dharma is that from any point, it's like every point of the Dharma touches every other point pretty directly. So in taking this talk in, this reflection that I'm going to offer in, it may land in some way, or you may have some reflection or question that arises in you that seems unrelated, but that's okay. So I'm open to a broader discussion. So the theme that I thought about talking about for a few minutes is the theme of confidence, of faith. Faith isn't a word that I use very often. It has a kind of a meaning to it where we're, at least I think perhaps from our Judeo-Christian tradition, that we put faith in something that is not verifiable, that we put faith in something that can't be seen or touched. And for some of us, that has some challenge to it. So that that idea of faith being in something that we don't really have any verifiable experience of can not resonate so well for some of us. The term confidence, which is generally it's more, at least the way I think of confidence, it's more confidence in one's personal effectiveness or personal abilities, or confidence in someone else's personal abilities. It's more tangible in a way. The sense of confidence can feel more tangible. And in very many ways, the faith that's talked about in the Buddhist practice, it has a few different aspects. It has the aspect of faith in the capacity that we have as human beings to wake up. And that may be something that we have to take on, take on faith, because initially we may not have the sense of verified sense that it is possible to really let go of the ways that we cling and the ways that we cause ourselves suffering. So that's one aspect of the faith in the Buddhist practice, a faith or a sense of confidence that it's possible, that there's a possibility that we can release our clinging, release our suffering. The second aspect is a sense of confidence in the teaching, in the sense, in the path, in the wisdom, essentially, that the Buddha offers, and the wisdom that suffering has a cause. It's not a random event in our lives, and that cause for the kind of suffering that we have the capacity to let go of, that suffering arises due to conditions. And a good chunk of those conditions are actually in our own minds. That craving or wanting things to be other than they are, and not being able to meet things as they are. Is a great cause of our suffering. Just imagine for just a moment how it would be if you had no difficulty with whatever was coming up in your experience. No reactivity, or basically no problem. Whatever happening, it's fine. Basically this balance of mind, the sense of equanimity. Nothing would be a problem. There wouldn't be a sense of struggle. That's the kind of teaching that we can have confidence in, that hopefully we can begin to see it is within our power to adjust the conditions of our own minds. That we're, you know, if we were strictly dependent upon the conditions of the world for our happiness, it would be hopeless. But we have this mind that responds to the world, and we have some choice in how that mind meets our experience. So this is a wisdom teaching. This is just one, you know, small layer of a way that this wisdom is expressed. You know, it can come at this from many different ways to express this wisdom that we can have confidence in. Now, again, initially this confidence may feel like a leap of faith. It may not feel like something that we have direct access to. And initially we need to take in this teaching, take in this wisdom, and reflect on it. Think about it. Does this make sense to me? With that reflection, if it does seem like it makes sense, one of the huge aspects of the Buddhist practice is engagement. This really is a path of engaging. It's not one of sitting back and just thinking or taking in and trying to adjust our minds to believe something. It's essentially, the way I look at the teachings of the Buddha are as scientific experiments we can run on our own minds. Are we willing to run those experiments and see what happens to us? That willingness to run the experiment is the seed. It's like the beginning of that active confidence. Even the willingness to run the experiment is a little bit of that faith. It's a little bit of sense of, well, at least I'm willing to try this. Try it and see what happens. What if I follow some of these instructions? The instructions, and kind of just again, at a very simple level, you know, all of the teachings that we talk about can kind of come down to this sense of, can I observe my experience and notice how this mind is contributing to the reactivity? Not to try to push away or stop the reactivity, because that movement to stop or push away reactivity is itself a form of reactivity. So it's a kind of an interesting paradox. It's almost a koan or a sense of... It's not the way we would normally think that things would work. That the teaching is to turn towards our suffering, our reactivity, and see if we can let it be. Observe it. Get to know it, understand it. Now, there's all kinds of different teachings that filter out from that basic teaching of turning towards our reactivity, understanding, getting to know. But that basic movement to understand our suffering, this is the First Noble Truth, understanding our suffering, that basic movement begins to educate us in exactly how our minds do what they do. Something unpleasant arises. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. And we notice, kind of, we can slowly begin to notice the place where the feeling of contraction and pain begins to arise in that process. There's just an unpleasant experience. And then there's a not liking, and there's a little bit of clenching around the not liking. Then the not wanting, there's more clenching. And that aversion, there's this whole massive systemic response to that that is very unpleasant, very painful, and is suffering. And so observing, understanding this process through meeting our reactivity, meeting our suffering, begins to point out to our minds how they are contributing to the suffering that we're experiencing. And in that education, the mind begins to let go of how it creates suffering for itself. It seems kind of, you know, magical in a way, but, you know, the way I understand the way our minds work, essentially, we're created, just the whole biological way that we're created, we want to be happy. We want to not suffer. And the way we engage in our lives is generally to try to create more happiness for ourselves and to get rid of those things that we don't like. This fundamental underlying wish for happiness is not the problem. That's actually a very wholesome wish. But we fundamentally, deeply are very confused about what it actually is that will make us happy. And so we're running around trying to get the things we like, hold on to the things we like, get rid of the things we don't like, basically organize our world so that we can be happy in the way that we think happiness is to be found. And this is a very human misunderstanding. It's not cultural even. I mean, the Buddha talks about it, and we can see it everywhere. So it seems to be a way, you know, it's a way that our minds are work. We want happiness, and we're very short-sighted. You know, our minds are pretty short-sighted about where happiness is to be found. You know, it's like, oh, can I get this next moment of pleasant? Oh, phew, okay. Now, that's happiness in that moment. I feel it. It feels good to have that thing that I want. And then, the next moment later, somebody comes along and takes it away. Oh, okay, well, how can I get that happiness back? We're very short-sighted. We think of it just in, you know, how can I get what I want, get rid of what I don't want, moment to moment. And as we begin to observe our experience, we start to see that that very movement to hold on to something that we want or to get rid of something that we don't want is contributing to our sense of dissatisfaction, our sense of lack. And so the mind, in this process of looking at our suffering, the mind begins to get an education. It begins to understand that the way in which it was looking for happiness isn't really very satisfying. And we begin to see that there actually is a deeper level of satisfaction in letting go of having to have things be the way we think we want them to be. And it's that same pull towards happiness, the same wish for happiness, that begins to take us in the direction of letting go of the things that we think we want. I mean, I think we're very fortunate in a way that we're set up this way, you know, to be pulled towards happiness. And as the mind starts to understand that true happiness doesn't lie in arranging the world, that true happiness actually lies in being more willing to let go, our homing device that leads us towards happiness begins to guide us in the direction of letting go. So to come back to the discussion of confidence, of faith, so a lot of what I just talked about, we need to have faith in order to be able, willing to engage. And then we the third aspect of confidence, of something that we're confident in, is our ability to meet our experience, our ability to actually engage. That willingness to engage gives us at least a sense that we're willing to try. And then as we engage, we begin to see, oh, you know, this teaching on mindfulness, well, I can be a little bit mindful. And we begin to recognize our reactivity. We see how we're reacting. And we start to see that, I mean, initially when we first start to pay attention in our early days of being mindful, it can often be like, well, why do I want to do this? You know, all that I'm doing now is really just seeing all of the difficulty that I'm making for myself. So why do this? A little bit further, if you go a little bit further, you begin to realize that seeing it and knowing how we create our suffering is better than not knowing it. That ignorance is not bliss. And through the seeing, the witnessing, our relationship to our suffering starts to transform. And the meeting of our suffering with mindfulness, we see that that actually is less suffering than being caught in the suffering. That actually knowing the suffering clearly with mindfulness, we begin to understand that that's the way towards the end of suffering. It begins to become verified that there is some truth to these teachings, some truth to the fact that we have the capacity to engage and to change our minds, and some truth to the fact that we have the ability to engage. So I'm going to stop there, see whether this has brought up anything or any questions, anything. Yeah, there. And wait for the mic. So you're thinking of doubt? The opposite of faith being doubt, yes.
It's, I think, one of the four or five
hindrances.
Thank you. And doubt being the most difficult. And how does one work? How do I work with the doubt and the faith?
So I have some, you know, just a flood of thoughts that come up about talking about that, but I want to check in more directly and ask the group as a whole, what kind of doubts do you work with? What do you doubt? So just naming some things. You know, you can sit and think for a moment at, you know, what is the doubt? Yeah?
My doubt is, I believe When you oftentimes I hear something and I know it's true, but I don't understand it, and I just hang into the sense within me that it's true, and then a little later some small amount of understanding comes. But my real doubt is in my own ability to let go.
Yep, that I think is, so the first level of doubt is not really being completely sure that there's an understanding in the teachings, but a willingness to hold them as true or as possibly true. So that I wouldn't really call doubt. I mean, that's the seeds of faith, actually, that willingness to say, okay, well, I don't really understand this. I'll take in some more information. I'll, you know, reflect on this a little bit. That's actually the beginning of faith. So that part feels like faith. And then, but for many of us, the ability to do this is a huge area of doubt. Okay, yeah.
What came up for me was the probably doubt that what it is that I'm experiencing in the moment, the doubt that that is exactly what I'm, where I'm supposed to be. Because I have trust. And this I was thinking of a specific situation where I self-patted myself on the back for embracing something that was challenging, but in a compassionate, loving way back in April. Part of what helped me do that was having faith in that I was exactly where I was supposed to be, that this challenging situation was what was being brought to me, and so embracing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking that the doubt that comes to mind at times is could be when I question that is where I was supposed to be, and even today, where I'm supposed to be without, you know. Yeah.
So you brought up another word that I like within this territory is trust. Mm-hmm. And that's another great theme to reflect on with respect to this area of faith and confidence is trust. And this notion of is where I am, where I'm supposed to be. Can you say a few more words about when you might have that doubt? That, I mean, you said in that situation earlier, you did have that sense of confidence or trust that this is where I'm supposed to be. So when does it feel like you don't have that?
When I go to suffering, you know, when I'm in peace and happiness, I have trust that I'm exactly, that this that I'm being faced with is not a bad thing. I change the orientation.
Yes, okay.
And that, in the moment, helped me deal with it, and I think I practiced that in different ways in my life. I think now, at times, it's coming up maybe now when I feel lonely. This is when it was a personal situation. So now it's easier to be, for me, to deal with a situation that is probably has high energy and act in the way in which I describe, where I am being soft, open-hearted. Now that it has quiesced and it's months later, I doubt. And it's only probably, I don't know, I'm intellectualizing, that I'm feeling not as happy as I felt before. You know, a little lonely.
Uh-huh.
So doubt comes.
So that's an interesting point. So this notion or question of, you know, when I am, basically it sounds like the happiness you're talking about is the happiness of being able to meet what's coming. Mm-hmm. Not just that your things are going well, but that your mind is more balanced around the situation.
And embracing that equanimity was so important to me. Be able to actually embrace something that for someone else that doesn't practice this would think this is such a hard thing.
Right.
And instead, I had a loving, compassionate conversation with this person and myself that changed the whole thing.
So the what you're pointing to then is that when we're in the space of being able to meet our experience with that balance of mind, the faith and the confidence are naturally there. Mm-hmm. And that when there's the suffering, the doubt and the suffering are kind of intimately intertwined. And I think that's really true. Because essentially the mind that is enmeshed in suffering is the mind that's disconnected from the truth of the equanimity. And so that there's a sense of, well, you know, maybe I fooled myself, or maybe I you know, was deceiving myself. You know, that the mind tells itself those stories. You know, that kind of a trap. And this is one of the questions, or one of the reflections around doubt in general, is begin to get familiar with the stories that your mind tells yourself around doubt. Because doubt is a very pernicious kind of hindrance. It, as Joseph Goldstein likes to say, doubt masquerades as wisdom. You know, we think in the doubt, well, you know, we're reflecting in a very wise way. Well, you know, I'm feeling all the suffering now, so obviously all that before was just illusion and just imagination. You know, they say everything is illusory and imaginary anyway, so this isn't illusory. This is true. You know, somehow the suffering feels somehow more important, or I don't know, something that we get into the mind state that just begins to loop, telling ourselves that was all silly, that was a waste of time, that was not true. And so the first instruction around working with doubt is to begin to recognize the way that your mind tells the doubt stories. Because when doubt is recognized for what it is, then we have the opportunity to start to work with it. Another main issue with doubt is that with doubt, we are often so in the story of doubt that we have completely checked out from the mindfulness, just completely. And that's another reason why it's so pernicious, because it really is very sticky. It's like it draws the mindfulness out of our minds. So if we can recognize the doubt stories, we have some an inroad, essentially, into bringing mindfulness to it. And once we recognize the doubt stories, so recognizing, I don't believe, or maybe that was all hogwash, getting familiar with those stories, then turning towards, oh, okay, there's the doubt story. What is happening? What's actually going on? Often, if there's a strong kind of doubt, there can often be an emotional tone underneath it. I remember on one retreat, I went into a very strong doubt experience, and I don't remember how long it was. It felt like a long time. It could have been, you know, half a day. It could have been 2 hours. It could have been a full day. I don't remember. But at some point, I began to see, oh, this is doubt. And at that point, it's like, okay, well, doubt is what's happening. What does doubt feel like? And what I discovered in my own exploration that day was that doubt felt like grief. Because I had had such a sense of faith in the teachings of the Buddha, and I was feeling like I wasn't able to verify that, and I felt like I've lost my faith. There's no way I can continue on this practice. And there was a strong sense of grief of having lost that faith or that confidence. And as soon as I turned to that feeling of grief, you know, the practice was back. I was like, oh, grief. Well, I can be with grief. This just, you know, this just has feelings in the body. It has a sense of heaviness. And within a very short time, it passed. The doubt feeds on ignorance. And one of the antidotes to doubt, so bringing this recognition of the doubt stories is a big one. And then there's another, the antidote to doubt is said to be this quality of sustaining the attention on something. Just, you can, in a state of doubt, just say, okay, well, I'm experiencing doubt. And even if you can't feel into what's actually going on around the doubt, if you just pick something to put your attention on and sustain the attention, that will begin to counter the doubt. Because actually, I think a lot of our doubt is in the possibility of the practice. I mean, we essentially, you know, we get into these states of doubt that, well, how does this work anyway? And, you know, why would looking at my suffering, you know, actually help anyway? I mean, it just feels worse. And rather than actually trying the experiment, we're talking to ourselves about why the experiment isn't going to work. And so we're disconnected from the experiment. And so bringing that connection back, bringing that, sustaining the attention back, puts us back in the realm of the experiment, back in the realm of running the experiment. And that begins to counter that tendency of our minds to speak the story of doubt. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I'll hand this back to someone else. But that just reminds me of the fact that we're wired differently, and I would say that I tend not to doubt as much. So when doubt does come in, it's usually fear-based, or fear creeps in. But 9 times out of 10, I will use positive affirmation, positive uh-huh. as a way of strengthening my
absolutely.
And so I don't relate as much to the certain tapes. I have friends that have the glasses a quarter empty versus three-quarter full. And so depending on one's orientation, I think. So doubt doesn't happen for me very often, and when it does, it's probably big based on fear.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful to know that. You know, again, and you bring up a very important point, that we are all different, mm-hmm. and that actually the tools and techniques for meeting our doubt are different. You know, as you say, bringing in the positive qualities of embracing, of compassion, of kindness is supportive for you, and confidence. Yeah. So who else has, what other ways do people feel this experience of doubt? Yeah, Linda. Linda.
I feel it in the need to explain myself, and usually in writing, some kind of persuasive argument or a timeline of events, documentation of some kind.
So what is the doubt about?
My inadequacy.
Mm-hmm.
In the past and in the future. My unworthiness, my inability to function as a useful component of the universe or society.
Mm. That sounds painful. So the that's a doubt. That sounds like a kind of a doubt that's in the area of our capability, our capacity to to respond, to meet. And so what's happening for you is that it sounds like you bring in a kind of a bolstering energy that, you know, I'm okay, this is why I'm okay, this is this. So kind of trying to prove to yourself through rational argument that that deeper feeling of inadequacy is false. That sounds, yeah. So there's yeah, that's a painful pattern. And it's interesting to me, I've had a very similar pattern in my life of, you know, moving into that place of I'm no good, I can't do this. And a similar kind of pattern manifesting, you know, as doubt in a way. It's very wise, it's very insightful for you to recognize that explaining to be a manifestation of doubt. Because essentially, as you are connecting with that explaining, rationalizing energy, trying to convince yourself that you're okay, since that's being motivated out of doubt, what's actually happening is that you're strengthening the doubt. And that's what I discovered for myself as well. It was a discovery that, you know, all of those times I was telling myself, you're actually okay, you're good, you can do this, and here's why you can do this, that actually, when I was doing that, there was a little bit of sense of, okay, I am okay. Oh, okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. And I was clinging to that feeling that was created out of that storytelling, out of that, you know, explaining, rationalizing, justifying, I'm okay. And then I thought, well, the problem is where I'm feeling actually unworthy. You know, that's the problem. That's the place where the problem is. And I was working on that side as well, trying to meet that, trying to just be with that feeling when it arose. And but I didn't see, initially, I didn't see that the explaining, the justifying, I'm okay, I'm good at this, that it was intimately connected, that it was a whole cycle, it was a pattern, it was a yin and yang kind of thing, that they were completely intertwined. And I was trying to basically get rid of the feeling of unworthiness and hold on to this sense of I'm okay, I'm good, you know. With that sense of talking to myself coming out of that basically fear that I'm not okay, I began to see at some point, it became clear that I needed to pay as much attention to the positive storytelling as I did to the negative storytelling. And to notice that that is a manifestation. It was a manifestation of fear. It was a manifestation of doubt. And so in that, and that can be scary, because it feels like if I let go of that, that I'm just going to cycle into the unworthiness. But I found actually in my own experience that the telling myself how good I was actually a setup, because we're not always all the time at this, you know, things change in our lives. There's times when we feel good, there's times when we feel bad. And basically what my story was telling me is I should always feel good. I should always feel this way. And then when I don't always feel that way, it reinforces the fact that I'm a failure. And so that essentially that positive storytelling was a setup for me. It's like, okay, you know, I tell myself I'm good, I'm okay, and when I'm not good and not okay, it basically means that all was a lie. All of that telling myself I was okay, that's not true. What I really am is awful, and I'm really no good, and I'm a failure. And so they were yin and yang. They were intimately interconnected. And I discovered I really, actually the place that the work was more in the acknowledgement of the doubt and the fear that was arising as I was doing the explaining, the self-justification, yeah. So that can be challenging, and because it's there's a real sense of, if I let go of that, I'm not going to have anything. So you don't have to let go of it, but do explore the territory of it. You know, really explore that territory. And notice the sense of doubt and fear that's in that area. And bring in as much sense of compassion as you can muster in that exploration. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts? Okay. Dan.
What's coming up for me is I have this notion that when things are okay, in the sense that I have an experience of things being okay, I'm relaxed, I don't feel afraid, I don't feel deprived, it's because of something. It's because something has arrived or gone away or been done. And which makes it hard for me to relax and enjoy the experience of things being okay. I become tense because I think, well, this is either because of somebody else's actions or some random chance, and that's likely to change, or it's because of something I've done and I need to figure out what so I can keep doing it. And then if I don't have the feeling that things are okay, then the idea that things are okay because of something immediately informs the second idea, that is, well, if things aren't okay, I need to do something. Or somebody needs to either do something or stop doing something. And it's not, so now from there, then it's the whole proliferation of, self will run riot, if you want to use a 12-step sort of trope. But even when I'm not in the active self-willing trying to get this or get rid of that, there's just this very subtle, sometimes not so subtle. Actually, the more I look at it, the more not so subtle it seems. This underlying tension of that whether or not things are okay is somehow subject to a lot of complicated condition, sort of contingencies. And I'm starting to see that and like look at the other possibility, which is not possibility, what I know intellectually to be true, which is that things have no other possibility than to be okay, right? That's the point of the deathless, is that there's this thing that's always there and is everywhere that is fundamentally okay, and there's nothing you can do to make it not okay. So I don't know, I could riff on that for a long time, but...
There's a lot in what you said. I'm curious, is there a seed of doubt in there somewhere that you're pointing to? The place of the feeling like I'm not okay, or are you actually just in the place of... just observing this whole process unfolding and your relationship to the wanting things to be manipulated and changed and the realization that there's this tension that I have to do something or somebody else has to do something for things to be okay. Is there a doubt about that intellectual knowing?
Is there a doubt about the underlying premise that at the end of the day things are always all okay? No.
No. Uh-huh.
No, I had a realization some 24 years ago now that things were okay. It happened while I was reading Be Here Now. And I've experienced a lot of doubt, sort of provisional doubt about that since. But intellectually, there's a part of me that just knows for sure.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm the rare Buddhist who's also a Christian. I go back a lot to the first two verses of Genesis, where there's this formless void and a wind from God blowing over it, right? And then God does this papancha thing in 7 days.
That's great.
and I have somewhere in me, pretty unshakable, not always observed or participated in, but always there is an unshakable knowledge that beyond the conditioned realm, there is this, as my rector recently said, there's a there there,
uh-huh.
right? That formless void is not, it's not empty. It's not an empty void. It's not a, you know, it's not a beyond everything, there's nothing. It's a beyond everything, there's everything. So, no, I do. I have a lot of, intellectually, I have a lot of confidence in that. But in terms of how I actually experience it in my body and how my mind responds to circumstances, very seldom do I actually get to take real, you know, live right. action refuge in that knowledge.
Right, okay. Yeah, so it's really helpful if you have that sense, you know, that there are times when we have had an experience that it does become that unshakable, you know, that it's not that we're experiencing it all the time, but we can reflect, yep, yeah, I know that whatever's happening here and now is just this product of causes and conditions, and it's all just going to change and flow, and what feels like suffering now is going to change in a few hours, and there's going to be something else there. And so we can intellectually know that without being in the moment experiencing that. And that is a way that faith works, that confidence works, you know, that we can use that intellectual reflection as a way to counter that provisional doubt, in a sense, you know, that just remembering. I remember on one retreat, I had a very strong insight into the emptiness of my own thoughts. It's like any thought that arose. I mean, and they were thoughts like, you're a failure. You're no good. You're a bad person. You know, that kind of thing. There were these thoughts. And I, at some point, just really clearly saw, that's just a thought. That's just created by my own mind. It doesn't have any reality other than the reality or truth that my own mind ascribes to it. It was a very profound recollection, a realization into the emptiness of the formations that happen in the mind. And the next morning, you know, I woke up and there was resistance to getting out of bed. It's like I was on retreat and, you know, the alarm goes off at 3:30 or something and there's this resistance. And then there's this recognition, oh, that resistance is just a formation in the mind. You know, there's no truth to this resistance other than the truth that the mind is giving to it. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, then I'll just get up. And for, I'd say, you know, 2 or 3 days, maybe not even that long, it seemed like a couple days, there was a very strong ability for that insight to permeate into my experience. I could just remember that insight of seeing that my thoughts are just these blips and there's no reality to them other than what the mind... It's like there's a blip of thought in the mind and then there's this accretion that happens in the mind to make it true or to create a thing around it. And it's just like, wow, that's so amazing. And just the recollection of having seen how that worked supported me over the next few days to just let go of any negativity, any kind of, you know, thought that was outside of the moving me towards the direction of letting go. And then that, you know, the kind of freshness of that seemed to recede. And it's not the lived experience so much, but there's a very, very strong sense of the truth of that. I mean, it's known. It's in there. It's not really intellectual, actually. It's like the body and mind have changed as a result of that realization. And I can remember that, and it does inform my the way I relate to things. But it's kind of like it's a verified faith, a verified sense of truth, that I know deeply, unshakably that is true. And yet I still get caught, you know, so, but, you know, remembering It seems like it happens more and more quickly that we can remember. The path is to just notice this suffering here and now. Notice how the mind is creating that suffering. And, you know, it doesn't always just poof, disappear. I mean, sometimes it poof, disappears, but not very often. So that kind of experience can be a source of kind of, it's kind of, to me, it feels like a homing signal, you know, that when we do have an experience like that, it becomes a kind of a guide, you know, that direction, head in that direction. Thank you. We still have a few more minutes. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first time I heard that my thoughts are the greatest deceiver, it changed my world, really. And I knew it was true, but I still didn't. So I work with it all the time. And it was a gift of a whole new gate for me of freedom. And I'm not there all the time, but it's firm. I have that same firm basis that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I've lived my whole life that way, so it's like when I...
Which way? You lived your whole life?
Well, my thoughts and my analysis of this and my control of things and
yes,
all that
okay.
Uh-huh. Has a lot to do with control. And I raised a large family, and I thought I was in control until, you know, kids didn't do it just the way it was supposed to be done. And so I let go of some of that. But when I actually think that my thoughts are the greatest deceiver, that's a huge statement.
It is, and it is true. And I want to put a balance on it as well, because I heard a story about someone who came up to, I think it was to Gil, who said, you know, I was in a cult once, and they told me I didn't have to believe my thoughts. And, you know, so anytime doubt came up about the cult, it's like, well, that's just the thought. So there is a balance in here, and the balancing factor is around non-harming. That our practice is grounded in non-harming, and we have some kind of verifiable things in our experience to checking in around suffering. You know, we know when we're experiencing suffering. That's not necessarily a thought, it's an experience. You know, and we know when we're causing someone else suffering. You know, we can see when there's pain happening. And so the grounding in this is around non-harming. And so we could potentially, I mean, you know, one of the ways this teaching around our thoughts are simply the great deceiver, or our thoughts are, there's no more truth to our thoughts than we give to them, is that we could be thinking, okay, well, I'm gonna, you know, steal these things and, you know, the fact that these people are, you know, angry or whatever, or feeling pain around that, that's just their thoughts, and, you know, I don't have to worry about that. So to balance the way that this teaching can be skewed, it needs to be grounded in that non-harming. That is the kind of container that the whole teaching rests in. And I'm so grateful for that aspect of the teaching, because it really does provide a corrective. And we can see, you know, that you know, if somebody is like, you know, in a cult. I mean, I heard about the Jones. I saw a thing about the Jonestown cult, and there were many, many beautiful things around the way that community formed, and yet then they started stockpiling weapons, you know, and then there started being this divisiveness, and so the sense of non-harming wasn't a part of that container. So if your mind is telling you things like, I'm not, you know, that this thing that I'm about ready to do, well, I don't need to worry about how it lands because it's all just, you know, imaginary. Check into the whether there will be harming or not. The teaching of the Buddha is really grounded in the real world. It's grounded in the conventional world. I mean, there's sometimes this notion of conventional and transcendent reality, and some religions or some paths seem to be taking the transcendent reality to be the goal. You know, let's just transcend this world. And to me, one of the beauties of this practice is that we get to that transcendence through here and now, and through behaving compassionately here and now. So I just wanted to put that kind of balance out there around our thoughts. So, you know, if your thoughts are questioning around, well, did I cause harm? Did I? Allow yourself to bring that reflection in. I mean, not to beat yourself up, but, you know, we need to not just dismiss some of the thoughts as being deceptive, but looking at our behavior, our thoughts, all within this container of non-harming. Most of our thoughts, however, are self-harming. Those tend to be the ones that are the great deceiver. You know, the ones that I was telling myself, you're no good, you're a failure, you're, you know, those are the great deceiver. The thoughts of propping myself up, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. In a sense, those are true thoughts, and yet they were motivated out of the fear, and that fear was a deceiver. So there's no need to actually think you're okay or you're not okay. There's no need. There's just experience. I am. There's just experience. Okay, we need to stop. So thank you for your participation.